Since I started this with the discovery in early 1986 that something had happened to me that was genuinely anomalous and unexpected, I have had some very fundamental questions, of course, but the most fundamental one in many respects has been, how could they be here if they are aliens? And I still, that's an open question to me. If you've read Solving the Communion Enigma, you know that even if that's true, even if they're literally people from another planet, this is a very, very much larger experience than we have known, because they bring with them an entirely different reference to reality and to what we call spirit than we have ever known before. They are here, a lot of them. It's time to acknowledge this and start figuring out how to take advantage of the knowledge we must be able to gain from this reality. How do I know they're here? First, obviously, they don't exactly keep themselves secret. Second, because of four new discoveries that have fundamentally changed my mind, closing one basic question as to whether or not they are essentially part of our minds or something else, and opening a lot of new questions. The first of these is that rocky planets and watery planets appear to be quite common. The second is that a type of star called a red dwarf can also generate such planets, which means that they are orbiting not only stars like our Sun, which comprise only 10% of the stars out there, as far as we can tell, but also red dwarfs, which make up 80%. The third is that it has recently been discovered that there are even more stars in our universe than we thought. To be precise, 300 sextillion. Now, that is not in just our galaxy, but in the whole universe as we now observe it. That's 3,000 trillion stars. Now, that's a fair amount. It's even more than the deficit. So it must be true that many planets in this universe harbor life. But the argument has always been made that sure, this might be true, and it might even be true that some of them harbor intelligent life, but they could never get here. The distances are just too great, and since the absolute limit on speed in this universe is the speed of light, we are unlikely to ever find E.T. walking up the back garden. But then you say, well, light speed's pretty fast, isn't it? Well, actually, no, it's not. Our universe is so large that light speed is really pretty slow. In fact, very slow. The nearest star to Earth is Proxima Centauri, which is 4.2 light years away. So it would take 4 years and change to reach it, traveling at 100% of the speed of light, which we probably couldn't do anyway. It could only get up to maybe 95% under the most extraordinary circumstances. It takes light 5.5 microseconds to go 1 mile. So you'd think, oh, well, that would be plenty. But traveling at the speed of light from here to Proxima Centauri, 4.5 years, you know, you could get from Los Angeles to Tokyo faster paddling a canoe. That's the reality of the size of the universe. And that's just the closest star. Of course, we know that time dilation means that aboard the ship a much shorter time would pass. In fact, you'd go there perhaps in a few weeks of ship's time. So assuming you could carry enough fuel and get up to some decent approximation of light speed, you might be able to make it, at least from your perception. Of course, when you came home, if you just spent a day or two there, it'd be 8 years later, but that's another story. Now, it's also true that we're just beginners in the game of understanding the universe. After all, this is so amazing, it was only in 1925 that Edwin Hubble discovered that there was even one other galaxy out there beyond our own. He discovered the Andromeda Galaxy. 5 years ago, it was assumed, in fact, it was part of the bedrock of science, that while there are at least 125 billion galaxies in our universe, there is only one universe. In fact, the only person I have ever heard claim otherwise was the Master of the Key in 1999, who said, quote, "There are more galaxies in your universe than there are stars in your galaxy, and more universes in the firmament than there are galaxies in your universe. There will come a day when mankind will learn how to detect universes beyond, but most are so far away that their light has not yet reached your universe since the day of its inception." Wow, that's big. Now, when I heard that, I thought, it's ridiculous. It's scientific heresy. It is completely wrong. When he said that, it certainly was. However, since then, astronomers have found 9 areas of our universe where the nature of the background radiation can most probably be explained by the fact that in each of these places, it has collided at some point in its history with another universe, another whole universe, not a galaxy, but a whole conglomeration of hundreds of billions of galaxies. Not only that, a 9 billion light year void in our universe is most likely explained by the interference of gravity from another nearby universe, which is still so far away that its light has not yet reached us, even in the billions upon billions of years that the two of them have existed. It's amazing that we're out here in the middle of all of this mystery and all of this wonder. And that's just the physical firmament. But reality doesn't end there. Not even reality as it is now understood by scientists. It used to be that the idea of parallel universes was like the notion that there might be other physical universes, considered science fiction. There is in physics a concept called alternative histories. Now, it has nothing to do with history or time travel as we know it at all. It is not about speculations about Atlantis or whatever, but rather with what appears to be the truth about reality, that the universe is not a single isolated entity at all, but a component in a vast multiverse that includes parallel universes, which are literal physical places that are also right here. Every possible outcome of every event happens somewhere in what is probably an infinity of universes forever expanding into a void that is without end. In fact, the multiverse may be so unimaginably large that the number of universes it contains may simply be beyond description. Try 10th to the 10th to the 7th power. The 10th to the 10th. 10 to the 10th to the 10th to the 7th power. Does that have any meaning to you? Let's put it this way. The sextillion stars we were talking about a few minutes ago would be, in their totality, the equivalent of a single atom in a firmament so large. Think of it. The multiverse exists. If the multiverse exists, our entire universe, in all its unimaginable immensity, is to its tremendous greatness as a single atom is to all of the atoms in the human race. And bear in mind that there are 7 times 10 to the 27th power atoms in your body. And there are 6 billion of us on Earth. It doesn't really help, does it, trying to make all these gigantic numbers comprehensible? It's beyond imagination. So let me get more personal here. First, I think it's worth asking a completely new question about all of this unimaginable immensity. That is, what is it? When you focus on something like the atoms in an individual human body, the equivalent distances between them are at an atomic level enormous. going from an atom in your finger to an atom in your brain is the equivalent of going between two galaxies separated by a vast gulf of light years. Of course, electric signals flash over these distances in tenths of a second. We can see that the universe around us has a coherent and organized form. A galaxy has a structure. Clusters of galaxies have structures that obey the laws of gravity. Slow as it is, the light being emitted by stars reveals that it's all coherent. In fact, easily as coherent as a body, a universe, and far, far more complicated. At present, if you would ask most scientists, they would say there is no communication between stars or galaxies, let alone across the mysterious membrane that separates us from parallel universes. Yet their unity and order are dependent only on gravity. However, it has become clear that this is not entirely true. The reason is what is called quantum entanglement. Experiment after experiment has proven that if you connect two bits of light, two photons, then separate them, whatever you do to one will also happen to the other instantly. No light speed barrier. Now, remember how universes are born. They start out as an incredibly dense mass, no bigger than the head of a pin. Can you imagine? This whole universe we were just talking about was once no bigger than the head of a pin, and everything that's in it now, everything was in it then. Therefore, everything starts out touching everything, and everything, therefore, is quantum entangled. Whether or not we can address this apparently depends largely on our perception. So gravity isn't the only thing that connects us to the rest of the universe. So does quantum entanglement. And incidentally, in some of my meditations on Unknown Country on the website, I have experimented with trying to work with this fact. It's very interesting stuff. But why don't we see this? Why is our experience limited just to the four walls of our lives? We filter it out. We do this because of why we are here. We are here in this state of almost total blindness, so we won't see past the future and the reality all around us, but only the river of time in which we swim. This way, we won't know what's going to happen next. We will have the freedom, the precious freedom, to make mistakes from which we can learn. Our lives will enable us, our essences, to do what they truly want to do. We will thus discover ourselves in our truth. Our visitors know this, and that's why they hang back, why they allow us to make mistakes, to suffer and to fail, also to succeed. To enjoy. Understand this about our being. When we are in the state called life, we are immersed in the river of time. We're swimming in time, having experiences, reacting from essence, revealing ourselves as we truly are. Then, when the body wears out and we die, we enter the contemplative state. We leave the river of time and rise above life. We contemplate it and integrate it, and either detach from it and leave this process called the wheel of life altogether, or return to the physical, drawn back by unanswered questions. But not just to this earth. This is all much bigger than we'd like to imagine. Remember all those planets, all those universes, all those parallel universes? What you are doing is not small, and you are not small. I am standing here in front of an audience of vast and ancient beings, and I will tell you something that I know about almost all of you. You're here, this little tiny group, because you have probably finished. You're ready to move on to other worlds and other lives, to project, or perhaps to project your being into ecstasy, joining yourself to the wavefront of consciousness that is expanding in the darkness and the void, carrying forth the word that is God and is of God, and the light that is the song of being. In other words, you have the courage to face infinity and not need to turn back and re-enter the river of time with its comfortable limits. I was once with a visitor who was not as evolved as most of us. That's right, not as evolved. otherwise, you would not be among the hundreds or so people on the face of this planet who have assembled out of all these buildings to hear this. This visitor was old and wise. When I asked him what the universe meant to him, he replied by showing me an image in my mind of a coffin. A coffin. That's what he saw. And if you think of it, to somebody who is unfinished, who is still weighted by fear and struggling with conflicts and contradictions, facing the infinite is claustrophobic, going on and on, unable to find an ending, in other words, trapped in space and time. I'm here to tell you it's not a trap. And we all know that. We know it's not a trap. It's school, nothing more. If you're here, you're probably a graduate student. It's a shocking idea, this infinity in which we actually live, an unending, chokingly claustrophobic emptiness. Some years ago, I read a paper by an Oxford mathematician called David Deutsch entitled The Structure of the Multiverse, which made this completely outrageous idea seem not only plausible, but necessary to any sensible explanation of reality. There is a multiverse, almost certainly, and probably using the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, we're going to be able to test this and determine at some point in the future, near future, whether or not there actually are physical universes here, right where we are. We started out talking about the size of reality. Not this, just this universe, but reality itself in all its vastness. But I tell you this, when you ascend, you will find yourself holding in the palm of your hand all. And in our meditation tomorrow, I'll talk about the UFO experience I had last week and the meditation that followed it and how it is that we can, in this life right now, reconnect with the infinite truth of ourselves that is projected into these bodies of ours, living in the time stream. But only part of us is here. The rest is more vivid, more alive, more true, and far more real. The rest is entangled with the whole of reality, with every consciousness, with every event, with all that has transpired in time, and that will transpire in time, and beyond time, with the building, joyous, improbable, and surprising truth. The true being, a body that encompasses everything, that contains every star, every atom, every thought, the shadows of the mind, losses, dreams, and expectations of all of us, all worlds, Alpha and Omega. And when you see this and feel yourself as this, then you are free and you find the truth of being. And the best way I can express how it feels to live is that no matter your suffering and your fear and your sorrow and your love and your hope, no matter any, you find when you touch upon all and everything that you have returned to a childhood that you have somehow inexplicably forgotten. And you think, this is who I am. How could I ever forget this? This is the transformation of the body into the firmament, of being into everything. It is becoming the Stargate. You don't need a conveyance. Only those trapped in time need that. Those who cannot lay down the burdens of life, the innocent fly in God. When Christ said, be as little children, this is what is meant. To become a child is to forget time, to live purely in your body without memories, without expectations, with only the joy, the love, the pain that it brings. And don't reject the negative. As soon as you do, you at once embrace it. To push it away is to become its slave. Instead, dance with it. Make it part of your balance. There's a wonderful card in the tarot called The Hanged Man. I'm sure you all know it, with the man hanging from the rope and his legs are dangling. Turn him over one day and you find that card has a secret. It's also called The Dancer. He is the hanged man and the dancer. Life and death, dancing together. Dance with it. Make it part of your balance. A child, a new kind of child, not like the child you were in your young days, is not ordinary flesh, but entangled flesh. A body that has come to remember and to sense all that it is. This takes skill. The dancer skill of forgetting and remembering at the same time. We will practice the skill tomorrow during the meditation. But when we started out talking about the size of the universe and the fact that no matter how you look at it, there must be vast numbers of intelligent species out there, here is what is so incredible. Even if the chance that a living planet will produce an intelligent species is extremely small, say on the order of 1 in 50 billion, far worse than the world's most unfair lottery, an average galaxy, even with chances like that, is going to contain one or two intelligent species. One or two in a galaxy. That's not asking a lot. This means that even if the odds against us are just literally overwhelming, there would be, in our universe alone, and remember that there are many and possibly physical and possibly parallel universes as well, just in this one universe of ours, there would be an astonishing 125 billion intelligent species if it's just one per galaxy. That is 20 entire intelligent species for every single human being on Earth. Even if we are so rare as to be almost non-existent, the numbers remain astonishing. And so the argument goes, where are they? And prior to this past year, that was a really good question. And people who find the idea of ET disturbing or threatening could take comfort in the thought that we are isolated behind an insurmountable barrier of distance. Except that's all changed. It turns out that the distance may not actually be there at all. We all talk all the time about wormholes, stargates. William was talking about this morning, and oddly enough, as always seems to happen at the Dreamland Festival, it turns out that we're kind of all playing on the same theme without realizing it, because we don't really plan this before. Each one of us just sets up his own presentation, then we come. At this point, stargates and wormholes are cliches of science fiction. They have to be if you're going to go to other worlds in this universe. I mean, I've written a lot of science fiction. If I didn't have wormholes, I'd be sunk. You're certainly not going to get anywhere fast creeping along at the speed of light. So far, nobody has even come close to building a wormhole. One reason is that they were thought to be so unstable that passing even a single ray of light, one photon through one, would cause it to collapse. Another is that the amount of energy needed to create one would be gigantic, on the order of the amount of energy contained in an entire galaxy. For example, we think, oh, a wormhole is just some sort of something mysterious, but what it is if you take a piece of metal and you soften it or something, you apply some kind of energy to it, and you can create a hole between two parts of it, or more accurately, bend it until its two distant parts are close together, that's a wormhole. But when I first started reading about these, it occurred to me that bending space-time might cause a pretty large expenditure of energy, and that turned out to be completely true. So I dismissed wormholes as science fiction. Let me quote a scientist from a German university who was just published three weeks ago in the New Scientist, the British magazine of science. Okay, when talking about some of these recent findings, and I'm quoting, he said, wormholes can be propped open with nothing. Nothing. In other words, they are not necessarily incredibly energy intensive. That's the New Scientist of March 10, 2012, and it says also in the article about the new findings that they, quote, raised the possibility that we might finally be able to detect a wormhole in space. Civilizations far more advanced than ours may already be shuttling back and forth through a galaxy-wide subway system constructed from wormholes, and eventually we might even be able to use them ourselves as portals to other universes. And I thought, yeah, I understand now. Because I have never been able to believe any more than I believe that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is actually going to pick up radio transmissions from another star, that there would be beings traveling at stellar speeds, at light speed, through this universe. It is not a practical way of doing it. I mean, there might be somebody out there doing it. In fact, there are so many of us in this universe, and in this galaxy, let alone in this universe, that probably essentially everything that can be done is being done. And my guess is that given that parallel universes might be real, and therefore the physics of life in these, of existence in these universes would be different than ours, a lot of things that we would be sure can't be done are being done. Without getting too deeply into the technical details, there was a paper in the Physical Review D in 2002 written by a team of Russian, two scientists, a Russian scientist and a South Korean scientist, both physicists, that suggests that while wormholes that connect different parts of the physical universe might require a lot of energy to create, it would be much easier to use a wormhole to penetrate between parallel universes. Now this means, incidentally, that our visitors are probably more likely to be from parallel universes than they are to be from other stars in this universe, which I find absolutely fascinating, and it also explains an awful lot about my experience and the experiences of many of you. Because, first of all, you're going to be seeing and experiencing things that are radically different from the forms that you understand, that you know. And they're going to be, like, as I discovered, thinking in ways that are oddly similar to us, but also profoundly different. And it might just be that in their efforts to communicate with us, they might be doing things that make credible and total sense to them, but which we can barely understand, if at all, like crop formations, which no matter what anyone tells you, we really do not understand those formations from beginning to end and in the middle. We don't understand what they are, why they're there, why they come to the specific places they come. We have a lot of theories and a lot of guesswork. That's all. Now, for us, making of wormholes is probably very much in the future. Unless, of course, it can be done with the mind alone, which is not beyond the realm of possibility, and in fact, as William has been saying for years, might have been done in the past. When he was talking this morning, he was talking about the creation of the kit of the tools of Christ within oneself. And let me take that down this path. What he was talking about was finding a balance between pain and joy within oneself. In the Gurdjieff work, which I did for many years, the idea of the triad was absolutely essential. The triad being the positive force and the negative force in balance, and the third force keeping them in balance. This is an ancient idea, and it is reflected, for example, in the Sphinx. The loins of a bull are the negative force. The loins of the bull are the negative force. The courage of the lion is the positive force. The head of a lion and the loins of a bull. I mean, the claws of a lion and the loins of a bull. And the intelligence of the man is the third force that keeps the other two in harmony. The ability to have insight into who we are and what we are and what we're doing and the world around us, to take an objective view of life. And the Sphinx then sprouts wings, and the entire Sphinx takes off. That is to say, the kit is activated and you become a Stargate. Now, in the past, this has always been assumed to be hypothetic. In other words, you become a mystical presence. But I'm not so sure that's all it is. And I will tell you a story from my personal life of why I think that. This has just happened to me once. I was meditating. And sometimes when I meditate, I get into a state of profound physical sensitivity. In other words, if those of you who have meditated with me know that I view meditation as a physical process, primarily. It's a process of placing the attention on the sensation of the body and actually letting the body and the way the body feels fill a silence in the mind, and then the work of it is the mind, you go back to your mind and then you return and you go back and you return and the energy comes from that effort. Anyway, I was doing this and I had been having a lot of very intense third eye experiences during this period of my life that involved seeing other worlds, and I mean in great detail. Some of them very familiar looking, like our world, others so unfamiliar that they were really abstractions to me and I could not make them out or even begin to describe them, except that they had proximities in them, I would say, that seemed to be some sort of physical structures. In any case, I began to see another world. Was it lost in time? Was it part of my imagination? Was it another place in this universe? Was it in another parallel universe? I don't know. But I was sitting in my living room and also in a field, which was a wild field, with tall grasses that went up and kind of hung over. And I could see beyond the field. It was dark. It was night where this field was. And I could see beyond the field, low hills, and there were a couple of lights in the low hills, and that was it. It was very, very quiet. And there was a time when I would have said, well, when I realized I could feel that I was not on the rug in my living room, but actually in the field, what I did was I then moved my hands slowly down to my sides and felt the ground. And it was ground with grass. I was not in the living room. And I opened my eyes because it was surprising. And for an instant, I was not here. I was there. And then I was immediately back here again. There was a time when I would have said, well, this was my imagination at work. Now I would say, and I feel with conviction, that it was my imagination at work, but it was also a real experience. I was in both places at the same time. I did bilocate briefly locate briefly to some unknown other place. So I suspect that when our visitors move from wherever they are coming from to here, they don't use a machine. They only use machines when they are here. And those machines aren't even necessarily to transport them. Those machines are designed to make us look up. My wife Anne came to the conclusion, after lots of study, that she came upon some papers that suggested, in fact, showed conclusively, that strange and surrealistic experiences expand the mind. They make the left brain, the logical mind, work better. They literally make you smarter. And that increase in intelligence can be transmitted in your DNA. Now, Jim was earlier talking about ET coming here and altering our DNA. Well, yeah, it's happening right now to us. And you're at the leading edge of this because you're the ones with the most intense questions about this. Questions so intense that they cause you to do something so rare as to listen to Dreamland and Coast and things like that, to entertain these ludicrous, way-out ideas as something serious, and to come here. I am not so sure that the first human journeys to another star will take place in a spaceship of any kind. I think they are going to take place in us, and that it is a matter of realizing that it is actually physically possible to transform these coherent, ecstatic states, like I was just talking, just describing, into physical experience. That we can do this. That William is right. It was done in the past. That's exactly correct. And we can do it again. And we need to do this again, because we need to come to the same place that it's very clear to me, and if you haven't read Solemn Communion, I urge you to read it, that our visitors are in, where the veil between what we call the living and the dead doesn't exist. Because we found, Anne and I found, over the years, she was the one who made the discovery that this has something, the visitor experience. And I remember she was writing a chart. She had a chart behind her desk of the different things that people were saying in the letters that she was reading. And one day she said to me, Whitley, this has something to do with death, with what we call death. The dead are involved. And it turned out to be true in our cabin, even. The experience that Raven talked about yesterday. In the afternoon prior to that, Laurie Barnes, who I mentioned, who I hope gets to come to one of these Dreamland festivals soon, she's a fascinating, lovely, lovely lady, was walking on the road in front of the cabin, and suddenly she found her brother. And she walked up to him and said, I'm so glad to see you again. She was stunned because he had been disappeared 20 years before. And the FBI had finally declared him dead after a long investigation. And he said, I want you to know I'm all right, which is almost the universal thing that they say. And she didn't realize that he wasn't physical at that moment. He looked completely physical. And when she stepped toward him, he suddenly drifted back and just drifted off into the woods and disappeared. She came rushing back to the cabin, and by that time, Anne and I knew what this meant. It meant the visitors were around. Because they, when they come, so do the dead. Another time, we had a group of people at the cabin in upstairs in the living room. There were a number of people sleeping. Or sleeping in quotes. You can imagine how little sleep we did during this. Not a lot. And they found themselves, they were on cots and on a folding couch and so forth. They found themselves all simultaneously unable to move, but they could still talk. And there was these dark blue figures leaping around in the room like a, as one of them put it, like an acrobatic troupe. And they were talking and saying, there's another one, and yet they could talk back and forth, but they could not move a muscle. Meanwhile, in the cellar, the basement below, in another folding couch, a couple were sleeping, and they were actually asleep and were awakened by light in the room, and they opened their eyes to see a friend of theirs standing at the foot of the bed, and she was a person who had died in an earthquake in Mexico City a few years before. And she said, I just want you to know I'm all right. Once again, the visitors upstairs, the dead downstairs. And I've told you this story before, and some of you have heard it, and some haven't. I'll tell it again. A FAA inspector once became desperate to get a hold of me, was trying to get me through my agents and really working at it. And so I telephoned him to find out what it was that he wanted. And he said, well, I want to tell you a story. A few nights ago, our dog became restless, and when my wife took him back out, he was old and he usually slept through the night, took him back out a second time, she saw a big ball of light flash past the house. And she turned to me and called me and said, you're going to get a call. I just saw a plane going down in flames. At that moment, their son came running down the stairs saying, Mommy, Daddy, Mommy, Daddy. Little blue men came into my room, and they had Billy with them, his older brother. And he told me to say that he was all right. And the older brother had died in an auto accident the week before. And the man was desperate to know if anyone else had ever had such an experience. And I was able to tell him, Yes, it's very frequent. It happens a great deal. And in the letters, when you hear Annie reading the letters, you will hear her reading letters from people who have had very, very powerful experiences like this. And the UFO people have really tuned me out now, by the way, because MUFON and so forth, because I'm not talking about structured craft from another planet with alien scientists in them anymore. I'm talking about real life, which turns out to be far stranger than we can even begin yet to imagine, because I'm sure I'm just touching on the one edge of what reality actually is. This only looks like reality. This is a school. We're playing games here right now. Now, I would like to submit a thought here. Even assuming a very sparsely populated universe, there would still be so many intelligent species out there that there is a much stronger chance that if this type of movement that I've just been describing can be done, it has been done and it is being done. Scientists know this, and now that there is a meaningful possibility that travel across vast distances can be accomplished, you may be sure they're going to be taking a new look at the kind of evidence you and I deal with every day of our lives. Now, I say that with one caveat. The fantastic quote that Jim Mars had from Woodrow Wilson is true. There is somebody here with an immensely subtle intelligence who does not want us to know this, who does not want us to be free. That I was inveighing against those two congressmen who are trying to make it legal for the United States government to intentionally confuse the public in a republic which is dependent upon an intelligent and well-informed population. I'm telling you, George Washington was a mild man in many respects, but if he was here today, he would go for his gun when he met those two guys. I'm telling you, it is one of the darkest things I've ever heard of, and it's going to happen. It's going to be passed by acclamation. It's not even going to be discussed. Yeah. This is a two-party system, all right. Washington is one party, we the other. Now, here's something interesting, though. Even if you could cross between parallel universes, you would not be real in this sense that we are in any other universe you entered. You couldn't be, because you're not part of that universe. You would be something else. So then perhaps what we are looking at when we look at our visitors in our universe essentially is not real, but they are conscious and they are alive, and that bizarre contradiction perhaps can be explained by what was being discussed, was it yesterday or earlier this morning? I don't know. So much happens at the Dreamland Festival. I'm in a time warp myself. That what was found at Wright Field were essentially sort of fake bodies. They weren't entirely real. Was that discussed here? Yes, it was. Okay, good. And that could be that this is literally technology designed to project someone who is in a parallel universe into this universe and to enable them to function here through the use of technological devices. And maybe that's how, if we begin to do this very, very well, we will eventually be doing it too. I don't know. I can't answer that. But now it's going to get even stranger. And bear with me, because we're on an incredible new road here, and it's worth the journey. If parallel universes are physically real and movement between them is possible, even if only to a limited extent, then a great deal that now makes no sense about the close encounter experience comes into focus. For example, there are videos out there. I don't know if you've seen them, and of beings. There's a couple of videos of very, very strange-looking beings that are morphologically impossible. But the videos are probably authentic. There's two of them. And they were both taken by security cameras in Southern California. And I can, if you write me at whitleyatstreber.com, I can send you links to these videos. And one of them has been extensively studied by the local MUFON, which is a very different kettle of fish from the national MUFON generally. The national MUFON people are very conservative. The local people are much more on the ground and much more willing to look at what's out there. In any case, these beings seem to be quite real, but they aren't structurally going to work in our universe. And you can see as they move along in these security camera videos that they're moving very, very carefully, because it's obvious that almost everything about where they are is different from what they know. Now, these could very well be beings who have literally been projected or projected themselves from a parallel universe into this one. That's what it would be like, I think, if that was actually happening.
Rick.
Yeah?
In the concept of multiple universes, it's possible, maybe even likely, that the laws of physics between one and the other
are different. That's what I'm saying. But it we'll have a question period, never fear. So just give me a few more minutes. The speed of light has been another bar to interstellar, and for that matter, inter-universe communication. SETI has been searching for years for radio signals without result. They're probably out there, but finding them will be essentially impossible. And the reason I say that is because of the immense size I was just talking about of the physical universe alone, and the extreme rarity of intelligent species, and they almost certainly are very, very rare. That would mean that our actually hearing a radio signal from one of them is so unlikely as to be essentially impossible unless some unbelievable piece of luck took place. The radio age doesn't last very long. Earth was broadcasting more signals into outer space in 1975 than it is now. It has always been assumed that things like quantum entanglement can only happen in the quantum world, in the world of the very small. That is, at a level where things are very, very small. It's what quantum means. It's sort of a mysterious word to people outside of physics. All it means is the very small. Incredibly, it turns out that quantum entanglement is not limited just to the very small. In 2010, physicists Andrew Clayland and John Martinez at the University of California at Santa Barbara succeeded in causing a classically sized, that means a microscopic size, something that you could feel and touch conceivably, or certainly see through an ordinary microscope, a piece of metal to vibrate at two different rates at the same time. Now that seems impossible. You can't have a tuning fork that sends out two notes at once. But you can, as it turns out. The magazine Science called it the most important discovery of the year and said it opens up a variety of possibilities, ranging from new experience that meld quantum control over light, electrical currents, and motion, to perhaps someday tests the bounds of quantum mechanics and our sense of reality. That is to say, they're putting it in a terminology that the average scientist can accept, but what they're really saying is, this suggests that we may ourselves be quantum entangled mechanisms, which may be why I really did feel that grass on that night in that extraordinary and lucky moment of meditation when I was in a perfect state of presence and absence at the same time, when I was in a state of quantum indeterminacy. I doubt if the author of that statement, though, has any idea that the human mind seems already to be involved in quantum physical reality. So much for the quantum and quantum physics. At least as far as my life is concerned, reality is already indeterminate, malleable, and influenced by what amounts to magic. And I suspect that this is true for all of us. Just some of us, our boundaries shattered, see the truth. Could someone turn on the air conditioning again? It's, I don't know what it's like down here, but I'm stifling. Our indeterminate, multi-layered reality that you and I live in, that you who have waked up in the context of visitors, seen UFOs, had close encounters with your dead relatives and friends, people like Marla, who's been yucking it up back there through my entire speech, who live in connection with the dead, I suggest that our boundaries are shattered. Our indeterminate, multi-levered reality is not an illusion. The world of classical linear mechanics is the illusion. This world that whoever Woodrow Wilson was talking about wants us to remain imprisoned in is an illusion. They know it. And they want us here for some reason that I don't understand, because I don't deserve to be in prison and I'm sick of it. I want out. The fact that our visitors are seen walking through walls, as I have personally seen, may not be technological ledger domain at all. It could be learned behavior. Perhaps they are able to control their movement in such a way that they can go into superposition. That means that they are no longer a physical entity, but a solid entity, but rather a presence that's indeterminate in its nature, that is potentially everywhere in the universe at the same time. Perhaps they can literally go into superposition, and when they're in superposition, they're not walking through walls. For them, the walls are no longer there any more than space and time, as we understand it, are there. And it could very well be that they literally can walk in a second from another universe or from a planet trillions and trillions of miles away into your bedroom, just like that. The world of classical linear mechanics is the illusion, and it's being enforced on us, and it's time to unlock the gate. The fact that our The Santa Barbara experiment shows that indeterminacy can apply to objects much larger than photons. The object placed in two states at once contained trillions of atoms, and that's a big deal. It was not quite microscopic. It was visible barely by the naked eye. But the point is, we thought we couldn't even do this to one atom. We thought we could do it to a photon, which is much less material than an atom. But now it turns out we can do it to trillions of atoms at once. Given the speed with which science is evolving, in just a generation or two, we might well have complex machines that can be oscillating and standing still at the same time. Indeed, we might have a whole array of technologies that would look today to us like magic. People who change form and go through walls. The ability to transform into superposition with all the potentials for strange movement and limitless communication that this implies. Maybe traveling between the stars is even simpler than using wormholes. Maybe we are wormholes. We just have to learn to think about ourselves in a new way. Now, as many of you remember me saying on many different occasions, and as I reported in my book Breakthrough, I drove into a parallel universe, or perhaps across the gulf of space and time to another world, I don't really know, in a car, and with another man's child sitting beside me in Paramus, New Jersey. I will briefly relate that story for those of you who don't know it, and there will be some who don't. What happened was I was taking this boy to meet his father. He had been at our country house in upstate New York, and their country house was in Delaware, and we used to meet halfway, which was in Paramus, New Jersey, at a diner, and exchange kids in the summer so that one kid could stay for a week or two with us, and then our son would go and stay for a week or two with them. As it happened, they were going on vacation, so I was taking just his son back to Paramus, and then I had to go on to a business meeting in New York, so my son was not with us. And I came into Paramus, I saw the diner, I saw his dad's truck in the parking lot waiting. I took a turn near the Paramus Mall, which is just a big ordinary place, just like anybody in any city anywhere in the United States is going to see every day of their lives. Only I was suddenly in another world. Instead of going up to the overpass that went over the divided highway we were on, so I could turn around and go back to the diner, I went down into a sunken underpass and ended up on another highway where there were no vehicles, or at least nothing that I was aware, it was very strange. There was a shadowy sense of the presence of other vehicles, but I wasn't able to perceive them, and I was surprised. I said to the boy, I took a wrong turn, and I waited for the next exit, which came up soon enough, and I went up off the sunken roadway and found myself really in an area which was not of this world. The boy became alarmed and began unlocking the door, and I would, the automatic door locks, I would push it down, he would push it up, I would push it down, because his instinct was to jump out and run back, I guess, to wherever we had been, and I didn't want him certainly not jumping out of a moving car. He was really panicked. I don't blame him, I was too. But where we were, there were wide streets overcovered with lush trees and hills, grassy hills, and on these set back from the streets were buildings which were roofless and looked like they were made of sandstone or something, with serpentine bas-reliefs on the fronts of them, no windows, and little curved doors down kind of in the middle of each one. They were ominous, as you can imagine. It was very clear that whatever came out of those doors was not going to be a person, and in any way, shape, or form. And I just could not imagine what was going on. I was terrified, and I thought to myself, my God, if I never get back, then I will have disappeared with another man's child. And I can't do this. This can't be like this. And I was driving around this neighborhood, becoming increasingly frantic. And I saw at the end of a street some light. In other words, it was all shady because it was over the trees overspread the street. I went down there because at least I could get a bigger view of where I was, because I really was very perplexed. I knew the area like the back of my hand, and it just wasn't where I was supposed to be. I could see a rough field, and where the field started, the road continued, but it was very rough. It was overgrown with grass coming out of the of cracks in the tarmac and so forth. But I could see cars in the distance. So I got on that road, and I went across to where the cars were, and it turned out to be the interstate, about 20 miles from where we had left the highway 3 or 4 minutes before. But at least it was familiar. So I got on it, and I went back to the diner. By this time, we found the boy's not said a word through all of this. And I have not said a word. I don't want to talk about it because the father is relentlessly skeptical and very, very skeptical. In fact, so skeptical that when he's with my son and has him alone, he explains how I'm a complete nut and he shouldn't believe me, etc., and so forth and so on. So I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to get into an issue with the father. We get back to the diner. I see the father standing in the bed of his truck looking for us, because by now it's been about 20 minutes, 25 minutes to come all the way back from where we ended up. And he saw us going toward onto the exit, so he knows we were right there. So I get into the parking lot of the diner. The boy leaps out of the car and runs off toward his father's car, yelling, "Daddy, Daddy, Whitley took me on a trip through the Twilight Zone." And so I think, oh dear. Suffice to say this. With my son in the car, and at other times him and his son, we went through those streets, this was before GPS, with physical maps, and with a ballpoint pen marked off every street in the area to confirm we had traveled down it. We never found that place again. But it is there. In fact, there might be another neighborhood like that here, right now. Many, many, maybe millions, billions of all different forms and configurations, unimaginably enormous numbers. Maybe driving into other universes in a car isn't more than just imaginative misinterpretation of commonplace, is more than imaginative misinterpretation of commonplace events. Maybe such things can actually happen. And maybe we all know it. And we're here for reasons that have to do with living like caterpillars so that we can later become butterflies. I want to fly. That should be very clear to anybody who listens to me or reads my books. Maybe when we look at our visitors, we are looking at shepherds and not jailers who to the sheep they control appear to be more like jailers. And I'm shaking that fence, fellas. They better understand that this is one sheep that's sick and tired of being in this paddock. I want out. Being nipped at by dogs and confined to tight herds cannot be pleasant for sheep. They might look hungrily at lush nearby pasture and wish the shepherds ill, but they do not see, perhaps, the shadow of the wolf that is there, nor understand the meaning of his call. I've reached the point where I'm ready to dare the wolf. I don't know about you. Since the last Dreamland Festival, I've come a long, long way. I've begun to understand things far more clearly than I did. And with that understanding is coming a power of a very new kind. Our visitors no longer seem improbable to me. They seem inevitable, certain even. And I have the physics to back me up, simply on the numbers. If it's possible for anybody to get here, they are here. Statistically. In fact, once you learn how to ride this particular bicycle, I think that we're going to acquire the ability to travel between the stars also, whatever that may mean. And I have a feeling that great and complex machines might not be necessary. I think when we see our visitors appear suddenly, as I was saying, often as not, we are seeing somebody who is in that instant traveled across the barrier between worlds or stepped through a tunnel from a world in this universe untold light years away. You know, there was a wonderful book now I'm going to forget the whole thing because I didn't put the notes down. In any case, it was written by Colm Kelleher, who was working at the time on the NIDS Ranch, the National Institute for Discovery Sciences Ranch in Utah.
Skinwalkers,
yeah. And in that book, I interviewed Colm about this. It was just fascinating. Just when the scientists were taking over the ranch, on the day when they were literally coming to the ranch family who was there had the following experience. They were in their back garden and they saw an enormous wolf come up out of a swamp and approach a paddock full of goats, whereupon it jumped in with the goats. And their young son came out with a rifle and fired at the wolf, which at first seemed not to notice the rifle shots. And then finally, it jumped out and ran back down into the marsh. And when the scientists arrived, they found its prints, and they were able to test the soil, take casts of the prints, and determine that the creature weighed at least 300 pounds, far larger than a normal wolf, but not unknown in that area. 15,000 years ago, it was full of dire wolves, which actually were that size. So that gets us to another possibility. Perhaps in parallel universes, we haven't happened. The Ice Age didn't end, and there are still dire wolves in Utah. Or maybe travel between universes and travel between times can both happen. You know, God might be really easily bored. So if that's the case, this universes within universes is going to be real complicated, which I think it is. I think it's truly extraordinary. And to be conscious in it in any way is the luckiest of things that can conceivably happen to any entity. Once they are here, I suspect, is when they begin, the visitors, to use machines, as I said earlier. In other words, I don't think they're coming here in spaceships. I think they're coming here and then building what they need here to move around in our context. Because I suspect you probably can't leap instantaneously from place to place in such a small space. I'm just theorizing. But I don't often talk about it, but I will tell you the story of the time that I was in one of these machines, because I had that experience. I found myself walking out. I felt as if I had been called to go out onto the deck behind the house and that I would see the UFO if I did that. It was the middle of the night. So I did it. And there was this thing that it didn't look like a UFO. It was rather boxy. And when I got up to it, it seemed almost like a living thing. I didn't get into it, but the next thing I knew, I was in it. And there was a man beside me in a small seat, and he had a globe, a little globe about this big, and he was moving his hand on the globe. And I kept trying to look at him, and he would turn away so I couldn't see his face. And I had been told, I was told by somebody behind us, that we were going to, essentially, to an abduction experience, and I was to make sure that nobody saw my face. Which, of course, meant I was going to look directly into the faces of anybody I encountered. I thought to myself, I didn't ever see who was behind us, but they were obviously very conscious, whoever it was, because I thought to myself how much I would like to steal this thing. And from back there I heard this quiet sort of laughter. And the next thing I knew, we were in front of the house of some people I knew quite well, only we were in Colorado, not in upstate New York, and it had only been 30 seconds or so. There was no sense of motion. It was like sitting in a living room. I was absolutely no sense I wasn't on the ground. Then suddenly I was there. I leaned down after we got out to go to this house, and I put rocks from the driveway in my mouth because I wanted to try to hold them in my mouth so that when I got back, if I got back, I could take them out and then prove where they came from later, scientifically. I wish I could say that I had the rocks in my mouth when I got back, but they were gone. In any case, we went into the house, and the upstairs, on the ground floor, there were sleeping the parents of this child that I knew, and I knew the parents too, of course. And I had been told that someone who could comfort the child would come, and I was under no circumstances to look at her face. And so we went down into the basement where the child was screaming. And there was this terrible thing going on with somebody striking the child's coccyx with a silver stick. And every time this happened, a flash of light would go up her spine and she would scream. I tried to put a stop to it, but I couldn't move. As soon as I started struggling, I was ended up back upstairs. And I'm not sure how that motion took place, but it did. And there was a woman sitting at the kitchen table. And I immediately, of course, looked directly into her face. And the next thing I knew, we were returning to, I was back in the thing. And this time I was a little more conscious of where I was and what was happening. And when we came over the woods, over a woods, at the time I didn't know where the woods were, it could have been anywhere, it was like the woods were moving. And we were completely still. If you ever go to the movies and you see a movie scene from the viewpoint of a fighter pilot, you're sitting there still and it looks like the world on the screen is whirling around. That's how it looked. Because, of course, the thing had its own gravity. So I was in one state of gravity and the world around me was in another. That was obviously the case. And traveling back and forth these distances just took seconds. So whatever kind of conveyances they have, they're damn good. In any case, I got back, and I had no rocks in my mouth. I felt incredibly dirty and ill, and I recovered soon enough. And I called the family, and I said to the mother, hello, how are you doing, and so on and so forth. How are things? They weren't close in time. In fact, she was really very negative toward the whole close encounter thing. So I asked them, and she said sort of spontaneously, well, you know, we had the funniest thing happen the other night. I think those visitors of yours might be real. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, I really laughed at this, but I just had a dream the other night that there was one of them standing at the foot of my bed, and I wanted to get up, and I couldn't get up, and it was standing there, and I couldn't get up, and that's exactly what I saw happening to her. She was trying to get up. She was flopping like a fish on the bed because of the screaming coming from downstairs. The little girl was just fine, and so I just listened to the dream. I told the mother nothing about what I had remembered, and I listened to the dream, and but then a couple of months later, I was in the town with them. I was actually with them. I'd been out there for some reason, probably a book tour or something. And I said to her, by the way, this little Lucy, I'll call her, Janie, whatever, I'm not going to give you their real names, as this seemed like an invasion of privacy somehow. Have anyone that she considers really a special kind of an adult who's very special to her, who's not in the family? She said, oh, yeah, her kindergarten teacher. And then she said, in fact, she's coming over in a little while. And so I decided, instead of just stopping for a brief visit, that I would hang around for that. I decided I needed a cup of tea and this and that. And she didn't come, and so then I got sleepy, and I was hanging out. You know, I was in no way I was leaving until that lady came. And she came over, and she walked in, and she looked at me, and she just stared at me for a minute, and then she said, I feel like I've known you all my life. And then she said, oh, that must be because you're Whitley Strieber. And we let it go at that. But in that instant, between the two of us, I was seeing something about the truth of our world. Because that young woman, now a grown woman, has needed a strong spine in order to survive what has turned out to be a grueling and very difficult life. So I saw an act of grace that seemed like a terrible invasion of a family's privacy, of its life, and the comfort of its child. That's where we are. And when earlier, during Marla's session, we were talking about how this is family. Anne turned to me and she said, that's in so many of the letters. Family, family, family. And that's the truth of it. We're members of families that extend beyond this reality. You've got sisters, cousins, aunts, brothers, and probably children who are not in this reality. You're not alone here at all. You do have a soul, and you have more than that. You are, as I started out saying, absolutely extraordinary beings. Now, I mentioned I had a UFO sighting on the 10th of this month, the first one since 2007, and I'm going to talk about that before we start meditating tomorrow, because it is intimately connected with the process of meditation, and it was a lesson about meditation, so we'll do that in the morning. My conclusion, all of this that I've gone through today, is this. To find our way to the stars, and I mean literally and physically, we must find our way within. A wormhole is a curving of space that brings two distant points together. We are going to discover, or in the process of discovering, that one of those points lies within us all, and the other so far away that it is almost beyond imagination. We're going to the stars. Somehow, sometime, somebody is going to make the inner and outer movement that accomplishes this. In that moment, the inner life of man and the outer life of man will at last become one and the same. And what has been thought of as magic will be revealed in all of its astonishing power as the practical reality that it has always been. Magic will become science. The impossible will become ordinary. And the stars will be our destiny.